Today on Against the Grain. The Environmental Protection Agency is tasked with safeguarding the public from toxic exposure. But Jonathan Latham, director of the Bioscience Research Project, says that the poison papers, an enormous collection of documents, indicates that the EPA and the chemical industry have often worked hand in hand to mislead us into thinking that toxic chemicals are safe for human use, including the hazards of dioxin, permethrin, and atrazine. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Long before Scott Pruitt and his interim successor Andrew Wheeler headed the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA has been protecting the chemical industry and not the public. That's what a massive trove of over 20,000 documents indicates. Known as the poison papers, the documents were obtained from federal agencies, including the EPA, and chemical manufacturers through Freedom of Information Act requests and lawsuits. They implicate not only the EPA in knowingly allowing unsafe chemicals into public use, but also the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Forest Service, and the Department of Defense, as well as chemical manufacturers like Dow, Monsanto, DuPont, and Union Carbide. The Poison Papers are co-published by the Bioscience Research Project, and I'm joined by its executive director, Jonathan Latham, himself a scientist. Jonathan, let's begin with this astounding fact. The EPA has a database of some 85,000 chemicals that have been manufactured or processed in the United States, but less than 300 have been subjected to rigorous testing and only 5 have been banned. How is that even possible?
I would say that the 300 that you mentioned have not actually been subjected to rigorous testing. So we have a presumption that chemicals go on the market, right? That is the default. And so, you know, what we'll discuss later in this is that that presumption is part of so much part of the system that essentially, the system can't resist producing chemicals and having them go on the market. So, you know, it is incredible that we should have, because many of these chemicals are in our bodies, for example. And so it is an astounding thing, you know, that we really need to flag up. But there are many other aspects to this problem that hopefully we can talk about today.
So you're saying that even of this mere 300, even those aren't rigorously tested. So in effect, you're saying that there are something like 85,000 chemicals on the market, mm-hmm. and basically none of them have been tested, or almost none of them have been tested in a way that would yield the impact on human health.
Yeah. I mean, there's a deep complicity of the regulatory system to allow chemicals onto the market. And, you know, what I will argue is, you know, even if you had an competent and not corrupt regulator, you would basically have a very hard time actually sorting chemicals that were safe from chemicals that are not safe. Because at the end of the day, you have to establish, if you want to do it properly, you have to establish safety in terms of, you know, neurological effects, in terms of reproductive effects, in terms of effects on subsequent generations, in terms of immunological effects, in terms of gut health effects and so forth. You know, the list of questions that one can ask about these chemicals and that are highly relevant to our daily lives and so forth. Like, for example, are people who are in bad health protected from these chemicals, for example? Are people who are very young or very elderly protected from these chemicals? Essentially, when you start to think about it in a scientific way, you realize that we don't ask possibly even 1% of the relevant number of questions that we would need to ask in order to effectively be protecting the public. So we end up in a very difficult place. Like, how much money are you prepared to spend to put these on the market and do the experiments that are actually sufficient to generate a chemical safety process that is functional? And then the next question also becomes, if you actually if one had in a society, and it doesn't exist anywhere in the world, but a chemical safety system in which the regulator was honest, the tests were good, would any chemicals actually pass? Because you have compounds like BPA, for example, for which there are hundreds.
Which are plastics.
Yes, BPA, thank you. BPA is a plastic. And that compound has been found in the scientific literature to have, you know, heart effects, to have neurological effects, to have reproductive effects. And this is just one chemical. And so we can imagine that if we actually put the same amount of research into other chemicals, we would come up with similar answers. And the question is, ultimately, is biological life compatible with synthetic chemicals that are long-lasting in the environment and that we're exposed to at high levels? Because the evidence from our ecosystems is that it's not compatible.
Putting aside the interweaving aspects of the implications of synthetic chemicals on our bodies, on the ecosystems that we are part of, you are suggesting, though, that the EPA is negligent in even the most sort of rudimentary attempts at testing the chemicals that are on the market. And so I want to ask you, in what way does the EPA operate, and what allows for there to be a public perception that the EPA is there as the guardian of our health, the watchdog to make sure that toxic chemicals are not allowed onto the market? And yet, in fact, we're surrounded by all sorts of chemicals, and the EPA has been complicit in it.
Mm. So this is the big question here. So what we have observed from the poison papers is that, in the first place, EPA, one of its major functions is to evaluate chemicals before they come onto the market. The current system is that there is a set of independent chemical testing labs, so-called independent, because I don't really believe they are meaningfully independent. Independent chemical testing labs that do the rat experiments, the rubbing in the eyes and the skin toxicity and the long-term chronic toxicity tests. So these labs do those tests. Then they pass on usually summaries to the applicant, who is the company, and then the company passes that on to the EPA. So you have a long paper trail before the thing gets to the EPA. And what EPA has seen numerous, numerous times over the course of its history and emanating from many different versions and iterations of these labs is that the tests are very often fraudulent and faulty. And even if they're simply faulty, what EPA is doing is allowing companies to withhold information about those tests. So, for example, they'll be missing experiments. Like, why did, you know, they've agreed, if the way the system is set up is a protocol is agreed to test a specific compound, and then what the companies are submitting, what the applicant's submitting, is a violated protocol. And the protocol has missing lungs, missing livers, missing animals, missing all kinds of stuff. And so the obvious question becomes, well, are these things missing because the company is incompetent, right? Or is it missing because actually there was evidence of harm and they didn't wish to submit it? But either way, the EPA should not be accepting this data. It doesn't really matter at the end of the day whether they're incompetent or whether they're fraudulent. So you see this evidence of all these submissions going to the EPA, which are either fraudulent or faulty. And the EPA does nothing about it, right? So the question becomes, why does the EPA do nothing about it? Like, what kind of regulatory agency behaves in that way? So I want to put that together with another piece of information. When EPA receives these submissions, quite often there is still some evidence of toxicity, like chronic toxicity or carcinogenicity, like elevated levels of tumors in treatment groups and so on and so forth, often in dramatic ways. And what the EPA does is they treat the evidence of harm, say the elevated tumors or the novel chronic toxicity or the early deaths of animals, as if they were aberrations. And they take this because their presumption, as I said earlier, their presumption seems to be that all chemicals are safe. And if there is evidence of unsafety, they treat it as if it's some kind of, a mistake has been made. So that's what I mean by an aberration. So they treated them that way. And so they basically find ways in which to minimize or reduce or wash away or essentially ignore that data. So you see them using all these pseudoscientific arguments. So, for example, they will look at the controls, and they will say, "Well, in the past, we've had controls that showed higher levels than these controls, and if those controls have been used, that would basically eliminate the evidence that we have in front of us that there's elevated toxicity in the treatment group." So, the use of historical controls, it's called, is commonplace in regulatory science. The use of those controls is entirely unscientific. Right? The whole point of a control is you do it at the same time in the same place as the animals with the same batch of animals under the same temperature conditions because you know what's often found is that controls differ over time and space and so
sure.
forth. So this has no scientific basis using these historical controls. Or they will take, for example, they'll find data in which they have elevated levels of cancer in, say, the male rats, but not in the female rats. And they will look at that elevated levels, those elevated levels in the male rats, and they'll say, well, that's not consistent with the female rats. Presumably, that's because it resulted from some aberration. And so you see these arguments being made by the evaluators. And so what you're perceiving is a whole set of basically pseudoscientific arguments being used to minimize and disappear this evidence of harm. And you see what you see is the iterations of this process. So imagine that the tested chemical has all these different evidences of harm, you know, elevated levels of different kinds of tumors in different tissues and all this data that's quite hard to explain away if you looked at it in face value. What happens is some of it gets removed at the first level of evaluation. And then, for example, somebody will say, well, these elevated levels of cancers in the original tissues, maybe that's because the original pathologist was you know, not doing a good job. So we'll go look at those elevated levels of the tumors in the animals. We'll look at the slides again. And lo and behold, somebody will say, well, these ones, well, maybe they weren't cancers after all. Maybe they were just warts, or they were just non-malignant bumps, and so on and so forth. And so they'll go through this process until eventually at the nth level of study, the final report is written in which it basically says there's no evidence of any harm. And what's interesting about this is that these arguments are very compartmentalized. So, you know, one individual evaluator at EPA will not necessarily know that everybody else has been doing this too, right? So they will have a small amount of evidence of harm in front of them, and they'll go kind of, you know, I don't really believe this, do you know what I mean? But they won't see the whole picture. So you see this process going on, and it's totally inconsistent with the precautionary principle, with science, in fact. But nevertheless, they're doing it. And they're all doing it, and they're doing it in different ways, and they're finding different arguments. And I haven't gone anywhere near exhausting the number of different arguments that they use. And the sensation that you get is that any argument will do at the end of the day. And the question then becomes, why is the agency doing this? Why wouldn't agency, whose sole job is to protect the public, do that? And the answer is that you have to think about the EPA's position. Political position in Washington, D.C. So imagine that you are a junior person and you work at the EPA and you find all this evidence of carcinogenicity in the Monsanto's newest product or some company, big company's newest product, of which there, you know, there's all this hullabaloo about how exciting this insecticide will be or how exciting this pesticide will be. And you are basically standing in the way of a huge multinational corporation and massive profits for them. And you can't make that decision yourself. You have to pass it on to your boss. And your boss will pass it on to their boss. And their boss will pass it on to their boss. Because this is not something that even can be done at the level of, you know, senior EPA management. Basically, well, that decision ultimately will go to the head of the EPA and then to the president. And the president is not an environmentalist, right? The president is worried about the next election. They're worried about their chemical industry donors. They're worried about the economy. They're worried about all these things that an EPA decision to ban a $1 billion product is going to get in the way of all of those things. And so that the EPA basically has to make a decision as an agency. Are we going to back this, you know, taking down this billion-dollar product of a multi-billion-dollar organization or not? And the EPA is never going to do that because it has no allies in Washington. There's nobody to support it. It's going to be against all these huge players. So essentially what the agency has to do is avoid ways of confronting these massive industries. And this is the way they do it, right? So everybody in the agency is burying little bits of the data, and incrementally it's all washed away so that things that have these humongous toxicities sometimes are basically billed as safe at the end of the day.
That's the voice of Executive Director of the Bioscience Resource Project, Jonathan Latham, which has co-published the Poison Papers. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And we're talking about what those papers indicate about the very tight relationship between state regulators and the chemical industry. So let me ask you more about the way the EPA operates, and we'll talk as we go on about the political motivations for the EPA, which the Poison Papers, interestingly enough, also reveal the complicity of other state regulators in supporting the chemical industry even before the founding of the EPA in 1970. But in the 1970s, there was a scandal involving the Industrial Biotest Laboratories, which was a ostensibly independent laboratory that ran safety studies on hundreds of chemicals with the purpose of testing them for the Environmental Protection Agency. Mm. What was revealed about those tests, and what was the consequence of the revelations?
Yeah. So first of all, just to the point of whether that company was independent or not, this was the company's called Industrial Biotest Labs. They are billed as an independent company, but it turned out, it came out in court, they were owned by Nalco, which is a chemical company. And so just to set that aside for a moment. So what happened in the IBT scandal is that somebody from the FDA perceives, a guy called Adrian Gross, perceives that what is being submitted to the FDA is fraudulent data. He makes a guess.
And this is the Food and Drug Administration.
Yeah, thank you. And so he goes down to the facility that he's getting these reports from on his own dime, basically. And he walks in the door, and the secretary tries to call the police on him. But in the meantime, he goes into the labs. And when he goes into the labs, he realizes these are not scientific experiments going on here. There are rats running around on the floor. The sprinkler system has been left on. There's dead animals everywhere. And so he's seen enough already, right, to know what's going on. It confirms everything that he suspected. So it turned out that this lab, which was performing about 35% of all the chemical testing in the country at the time. So it tested glyphosate, it tested atrazine, it tested 2,4-D, it tested dicamba, tested PCBs. Turns out that this lab has been submitting fraudulent data for years. And the EPA finally, you know, in investigating, there's a statement in the Poison Papers in some meeting minutes, basically saying that, you know, as of this point, this is a year and a half into the investigation, we have not found a single application that is consistent with the original data that the company had. Okay, so they have lied about every single experiment they've done, and that probably isn't all of them, but I think that probably that you could extrapolate that fairly confidently. Certainly, EPA could reasonably do that. So. They were doing fraudulent tests. They were forging signatures. They were making up data. They had hired somebody from Monsanto to test PCBs, which are a Monsanto product, right? So you know, it's the worst of the worst. And what happens at that point is this. So this is not, you know, all of what I've told you is known. You don't need the Poison Papers to figure this out. But what's interesting about the Poison Papers is they show that EPA tried to cover this whole thing up. Because imagine you are EPA and you've discovered that every test, you know, just a year into your investigation, you discovered that every test is fraudulent. What do you do, right? Do you basically name all the chemicals and tell the public what the issue is here, go, you know, make a clean breast of it, as it were. And basically the public is going to say, well, I'm not going to use glyphosate. I'm not going to use atrazine. Companies, you know, there's going to be a crisis, right, of agriculture, of public confidence in the EPA, of public confidence in the chemical industry, of public confidence in the substances themselves. So what they do is they string out their investigation for 7 years, pretending to investigate to the nth degree all these studies, which they, at an early date, had already knew that it was all fraudulent and it was all falsified. So, but they string it out in order to buy time. So they don't tell anyone what the chemicals are. And so they, and then they string out their investigation to buy the chemical industry time to redo the test, so that when EPA finally reveals everything, and it's going to come out in court too, because, you know, people go to prison over this. When it finally comes out, the companies can say, well, we've retested everything and you don't need to worry. But the EPA was totally complicit in this. And they were totally complicit too in many of those tests are still part of the data, the literature. And the reason this part of the literature is because EPA accepted all kinds of cobbled together versions of experiments. They were even accepting experiments from this company that they would not, the company themselves, the employees would not sign.
So you're saying that chemicals that are used today, that if you were to look for the safety data on them, it comes from these fraudulent tests in the 1970s?
Yeah, some was redone, but much was not.
What was the fallout from that scandal? How did the EPA then try to, you're talking the immediate fallout in terms of prolonging the investigation period. But one of the documents that are found in the Poison Papers relates to a meeting that took place between the EPA and its Canadian equivalent, the Health Protection Branch. Tell us about that.
So this is where some of the information I just described comes from that document. So the document, you know, the EPA is telling the chemical industry very accurately what it's finding. And so they're finding, you know, this is how I know that they're accepting unsigned documents. They were accepting things that were cobbled together, and they were accepting all manner of, you know, unscientific procedures as part of their process of basically trying to patch, you know, stick this whole house of cards back together again. And so what happened subsequently is that the EPA instituted a system called good laboratory practice. And it was supposed to be to prevent this kind of disaster from happening by generating this whole system of tick boxes and so forth. There's very expensive certification process that you can now obtain if you want to do chemical testing and the EPA to actually pay attention to your results, you have to go through this process. But what was really problematic about this system is not the tick boxing. The tick boxing solved nothing and in fact made things worse, because it means that this peer-reviewed scientific literature is no longer counted by the EPA. When somebody from UCSF or some other university does a toxicological study, the EPA doesn't even look at that, because those labs are not certified as GLP, good laboratory practice. So it actually made things worse by excluding the entire paid for scientific literature done by independent academics and left the field open for commercial labs who are doing these tests as companies who are basically, they're beholden to their customer, and their main customer is the chemical industry, right? This is the root of the problem, that companies like IBT, even if they weren't owned by Nalco, they would still have as their primary customer the chemical industry. If the chemical industry perceives that some lab is being too rigorous or you know, giving their products red flags, they'll just go somewhere else. Right? The business model is so obviously fraudulent and conflicted that it's hard to see how it could ever work. But what that process is the fundamental problem here. And EPA did nothing about that, right? And the reason, I believe, why they did nothing about it is because, you know, as I told you earlier, they do not want to have to confront the big chemical companies in Washington, D.C., right? They'd rather keep their heads down, keep their jobs, have just a quiet life. So they nevertheless have to go through this process of massaging data and so forth, which is troublesome for them. It takes them years to go through all these iterations of getting rid of this data, and they have all these committee meetings, and they have all these processes that they go through in order to do this. It's way easier for them is to have fraudulent testing, because then it never even crosses their threshold, right? So that's why they didn't solve the problem. And what if the information, if those tests, for example, were to be brought in-house to the EPA, then they would be subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. It would all be laid out. If they were doing it fraudulently, it would be very, very hard for them to conceal that.
So having it done commercially then blocks it from the public's eye.
Yeah, it hides it.
What is dioxin, and what role has the EPA played in keeping the public, in effect, exposed to dioxin?
Yeah. So dioxin is a substance that is a byproduct of many chemical reactions that involve chlorine and carbohydrates. So it's basically, when you add chlorine to chemical reactions, it is a byproduct that is stable. So it's one of the end products that if you run the reaction too fast or too far or too hot, you'll generate large amounts of this stuff. If you keep the conditions optimized for the production of what you want to make, then the amount of dioxin will be relatively little, but sometimes nevertheless can be very significant. So in the case of 2,4-5-T, for example, 2,4-5-T is one half of the herbicide Agent Orange. So the other half is 2,4-D. And those two chemicals were Agent Orange, and 2,4-5-T was very heavily contaminated, even under normal production processes, with dioxin. And so this is what led to the Vietnam veterans having all these health defects and the epidemic of birth defects in Vietnam and so forth. So this is a compound, and it's still a contaminant of pesticides today. So this is still a very relevant story. And for example, you know, if Monsanto goes bust, for example, people will start buying pesticides from China, from India, from Indonesia that we're pretty sure have very high levels of these compounds in them. So we will go back or to even a worse place than where we were at the time of the Vietnam War. So there's very high stakes here.
And the role of the EPA in not protecting the public from dioxin?
Yeah. So what happened was in 1970, Dow wrote to EPA and told them some or all of what they knew about the toxicity of these compounds. And so this is, before Agent Orange. Agent Orange wasn't banned until 1982 or so.
Both Dow and Monsanto produced Agent Orange?
Yeah, they did. Yeah. So they were both producing it. And other companies, too, were producing it. So what happened in the chemical industry is that they had quite a deep understanding of what it was they were doing and what harm it had, for example. So there's a letter in the Poison Papers from 1964 in which Dow is in a sort of a panic because they're ramping up the production of Agent Orange and all their workers are getting sick. And then they're having a virtual mutiny at their plant. There's a report in there about all the procedures they took to protect their workers. You know, they put a doctor in the plant, and then they got all these kind of cleaning procedures, and then they end up building a wall around the production facility and stuff. It sounds totally nightmarish, and no doubt it was, because the workers were getting sick and they were complaining about this. Anyway, so these companies knew a lot about their products, and they've always denied that they had that they knew anything about the human toxicity of these compounds. But actually, there's a letter from Dow, I mean, back and forth between Dow and a German chemical company. And the German chemical company tells them that dioxins are too dangerous even to research. And so they knew that it was human, you know, toxic to humans, really toxic. So, but EPA's role in all this is to basically sit on its hands, right? They have access to all this information. And there's still no regulations in the U.S. about how much dioxin is allowed in your food, for example. The only regulations on dioxins are about cleanups from Superfund sites. And they've finally published a draft preliminary report in 2010. And they had basically sat on the information about DocSense for 40 years at that point. So they have done nothing. And the loophole they have is that DocSense are not produced deliberately. So they're all byproducts. And so there are no laws about byproducts and unfortunate things as a consequence of the manufacture of industrial chemicals. So these DocSense are, you know, ubiquitous. Everybody has DocSense. Every person on the planet is contaminated with DocSense. DocSense, there's no safe dose. That means we've all been poisoned, basically. So we all are suffering, you know, a whole multitude of immune system problems and muscle weakness and carcinogenic effects, for example, of DocSense are well documented in the peer-reviewed literature. But EPA still is effectively doing nothing.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Jonathan Latham about the chemical industry and the Environmental Protection Agency. Jonathan Latham is executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which co-published the Poison Papers, a massive trove of documents that have been obtained about the cozy relationship between state regulators and the chemical industry. And you can find a link to the Poison Papers on our website, againstthegrain.org. Let me ask you about permethrin, which is widely used as an insecticide, also used topically for afflictions like lice. It's labeled as having low toxicity. What's the backstory of permethrin?
So, you know, this is an interesting case because it's one of the examples that are most carefully documented in the Poison Papers. So, essentially, EPA, when the final approval of permethrin was in 1982, the EPA already had they received seven different studies based on originating from different companies that all wanted to manufacture this product. So all of those studies were flawed in one way or another. And the evaluators of, there's a report from one evaluator who says basically that we are exposing the public to a potential risk of basically 10% of the population getting cancer from permethrin alone, if they're allowed to use it at this dose that we've recommended. And so this is the person who's gone back through all the evidence that EPA has accumulated about permethrin. And this cancer rate, you have to remember, is nevertheless based on what appear to be flawed and fraudulent applications, right? So they've been massaged even before they get to the EPA. The EPA, you know, what he believes that his colleagues have been doing is, for example, taking evidence and not showing it to external review boards. So the EPA has a system of sharing information. They have an sort of vetting system. But what he believes is that EPA, his colleagues, have not been showing all the information to these external review boards. Right, so the checks and balances are being invalidated by all this processing. So that's what I sometimes call administrative fixes. You know, if you can't find a scientific argument and you can't find a logical argument to ignore this data, you can always just give it to a committee who, if they don't receive enough information, are basically going to give the thing a clean bill of health. So permethrin is this compound that not only has this very high suggestion from the papers of carcinogenicity, but also what the applicants detected was that permethrin has this effect of coagulating proteins. So the rats were becoming ill in a chronic toxicological way, as well as developing cancer. This is interesting in part because coagulating proteins are behind many mental health issues like Alzheimer's disease and Parkinson's disease. So you have this set of illnesses that are caused by these coagulating proteins that become more and more common currently. And permethrin is not acknowledged anywhere in the scientific literature, so far as I can see, of causing these kinds of illnesses. Yeah, this was a very clear outcome from the test that was submitted to the EPA, but it was ignored. So the studies into the long-term studies that are often done on rats and mice, they're called long-term chronic and carcinogenicity studies. That means they're supposed to study carcinogenicity, but at the same time, they're supposed to keep an eye out for chronic illnesses that may be developing that have nothing to do with cancer. And so here's a flat-out case in which there's perfectly clear evidence from the studies that these animals have a long-term health issue resulting from this pesticide. But it doesn't appear anywhere in EPA's final summary. So they've ignored it. They basically, it wasn't even mentioned from the start. So EPA is claiming to be looking for illnesses and health problems that in practice it is actually not. It's ignoring them.
So given these examples, how should the public regard chemicals that have been approved for use and or labeled as, you know, relatively safe? Is there any way for us to navigate any of this if we're not scientists? Should we just assume everything is toxic?
The problem, you know, is a little more than what you say, because even scientists, you know, unless they want to go and read the 20,000 documents or whatever, and you know, they're welcome to do that, obviously. But unless you want to delve down into these documents, even the scientists who read the peer-reviewed literature, who read EPA's final reports and all the information that's publicly available, would not be able to know, because of fraudulent reporting and fraudulent submissions and so on and so forth, will not be able to know the toxicity of these compounds. There is no way for us to know, basically. So what I tell people is, you know, I use, in my household, I use wood and glass and metal objects as much as possible. I reduce our exposure to all these compounds, and I treat them all as untested. Basically, I assume that they are untested. And you can, you know, the second thing you can do, one can do, is go to the peer-reviewed literature. But the peer-reviewed literature is often quite a good indicator of what's going on. There are some compounds, for example, permethrin, there's very little information in the peer-reviewed literature about that compound. But you know, if you go to the peer-reviewed literature, you'll find many compounds and very little is known about. Another sort of stumbling block of the peer-reviewed literature is some of it is published by companies with conflicts of interest. And I would ignore that information basically utterly, especially if it contradicts unconflicted research, or what you believe to be unconflicted research. The other problem is, if you go to the scientific literature, it's only relatively recently that scientists have started reporting their conflicts of interest. So historical data often will not report conflicts of interest at all. Interestingly, many of the key toxicology journals do not actually require reporting of conflicts of interest, right? And this is the place where you're probably going to want to go the most. And the journals are actually, I would say, pet journals of the chemical industry. So you have all these journals that there's basically a scandal going on at the moment. It's in a journal of occupational health, in which one of the authors who set it up about 20 years ago, because basically couldn't get any of his research published in the peer-reviewed literature because it was all controlled by the chemical industry, set up this journal. And this journal of occupational health has been, you know, supporting him and many other people who have concerns about toxic chemicals, allowing them to get their research published in a peer-reviewed way. Not very long ago, the editorial board was basically was bypassed by the publisher, who appointed an industry consultant as the chief editor. And they got rid of the old editor without asking the editorial board, and the editorial board has resigned, and I don't know what's going to happen next. But these are the stakes, right? Is that clearly the industry has confidence in these other toxicology journals. They don't feel they have to remove the editor of those journals. But in this case, where you know, these are holdouts, basically, from the chemical industry's point of view. And so essentially, they've been targeted by a combination of the chemical industry and the publisher, right? The publisher is colluding with the chemical industry to shut down that journal from the point of view of independent research. So the whole thing is a minefield.
Scientist Jonathan Latham is my guest. He's executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. My name is Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what you're describing there about how the chemical industry has also penetrated academia, these scientific journals, reminds me of the way the tobacco industry also has functioned and the way that it bought off particular scientists and was able to have people on the payroll to help bolster up the notion that tobacco was not so harmful. And like the tobacco industry, there has now been the release of an enormous amount of documentation about, a lot of it through litigation, of the wrongdoings and collusion and cover-up of the chemical industry. And something similar is taking place with the poison papers. I wonder if you could just tell us about the origins of this collection.
We obtained just short of 3 tons of paperwork, primarily from a woman called Carol Van Strom. Also, some came from someone called Eric Francis Coppolina. And so there was a few and a couple other sort of more minor sources. What happened was that Carol Van Strom was writing articles for our website, and she was making strong claims, the Independent Science News. She was making strong claims about the EPA and its collusion with the chemical industry. And so I was saying to her, well, Carol, you can't put this on our website without supporting data. You know, I want to have PDF files of the minutes and the correspondence and so on and so forth. And eventually, after I asked her a bunch of times, you know, she's not computer savvy. She didn't know how to scan these documents. I wasn't even sure that she could actually find them in her collection. And so she basically said, you know, I'm just not bothered. I'm not going to publish anything. And she published it somewhere else. But I kept in mind her description of her documents that she claimed were in her barn and so forth. So eventually, I made some calls to find out who she was and whether it was really plausible that she had all this incriminating information about the EPA. And people said, yeah, quite likely she does. You know, she's been doing Freedom of Information Act requests. She's been doing interacting with lawyers, collecting their documents from court cases. She's had contacts with whistleblowers who have sent her stuff. So she has all this access to information. And indeed, that this was all true. So we raised $40,000, which is still a shoestring budget to do this kind of thing. And so we raised this money and we got it scanned. And she, you know, her history is really interesting because she was essentially sprayed, airily sprayed. She lives in Oregon, in the backwoods of Oregon. She was airily sprayed by a helicopter that came through the valley. And her children became sick. Her animals became sick. The fish in the river died. All this stuff happened. And she didn't know whether that was really the cause or not. But it happened again. So she's like, this absolutely is to do with this compound. This turned out to be Agent Orange. And she did not, she didn't know that at the time. But she's embarked on this huge odyssey of trying to find out. And it mushrooms from Agent Orange and dioxins, which are the contaminants that, you know, probably were the cause of all these issues, into issues around PCBs and issues around pesticides and all this information that she acquires. And some of it's, you know, purely company information. There's all these minutes of meetings between all the different chemical companies about what to do about dioxins and stuff, all this really fascinating stuff. But what's interesting about these documents in terms of the UCSF also is that, you know, hopefully journalists can use them. Hopefully lawyers can also use them. So there's this whole kind of culture of document holding among lawyers, for example. So they have, certain companies will have all these collections of documents that derive from previous court cases and discovery, which has allowed them to bring this, extract this stuff from the companies. And then what happens is if you have a big enough collection of documents, then you can see how that you can build a case against the company, the chemical companies. And so what we're really hoping is that these documents will add very significantly to these to these collections of documents that are now available for lawyers especially, but also journalists. And we've seen in the court case against Monsanto around glyphosate the important role that these kinds of documents can play. And so we're hopeful that some people will start to get redress from the chemical industry, because the chemical industry has been incredibly effective at fending off claims from the public, from Vietnam vets, for example. You know, Vietnam vets were saved. Basically, Monsanto was saved from the Vietnam vets, largely by a whole bunch of studies that Monsanto did on the people who worked in their own factories, who were exposed to dioxins, because they were manufacturing these compounds, right? They're manufacturing Agent Orange, so the exposures of those workers in the factories is really relevant. And there's a whole, the companies always maintained that humans are not injured by Agent Orange, apart from getting a rash. And so what the poison papers show, for example, is that the published peer-reviewed papers that are on the workers at Monsanto's factory that were exposed, there were three papers that were totally crucial to them fending off the claims of the Vietnam vets. Because these studies show that there's no harm from Agent Orange, right? Of no carcinogenic effect. It turns out those studies were fraudulent. Okay, so EPA sabotaged its own investigation into those papers. That there is an admission in those papers, for example, from Monsanto's chief medical officer, that they basically put people into the control groups and took them out of the treatment groups in order to make the results come out the way they wanted. Mm-hmm. And then there's an admission in the papers too, for example, that essentially, you know, they went through this cancer disaster. And we're concerned about dioxins as a source of cancer. And so this is another admission that they actually knew internally that they had a problem with dioxins and cancer that has, you know, never come out before.
Let me end by turning things back to the EPA, because over the last 40 plus years, they've played a really central role in, as you argue, not protecting the public, but protecting the chemical industry. Since the election of Donald Trump, his appointment of Scott Pruitt, who has been removed, but the EPA is still trundling along, there has been a sense that the EPA is under attack by the Trump administration, and therefore activists and people on the left need to defend the Environmental Protection Agency. Given everything that you've said, now obviously a lot of that is around climate change and shutting down coal plants, but just sort of bracketing that for a moment, do you think that the EPA is an institution that needs to be defended and shored up? How do you see it? And is it possible to reform it, or is it just too structurally compromised?
So, you know, just to preface this discussion, I do believe the government has a role in protecting the public, right? It fundamentally is absolutely necessary to have an agency that does the job that the EPA is supposed to do. But you have to go back to the origins of the EPA. It was set up after Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, and it was set up by Richard Nixon. Okay, he is a very smart person. He understands his way around bureaucracy and so forth. He set up the EPA to be a buffer between the angry public and the chemical industry, which was under assault at that time. And that has always been EPA's role. So, in order for it to fulfill that role, the chemical industry has to make a lot of noise about how they're being overregulated by the EPA, how they're being bullied by the EPA, how EPA is setting all these stringent rules and is stifling innovation and so forth, right? They have to sell the story, because if they didn't sell the story and they said, oh yeah, don't worry, EPA's in our pocket anyways, right? Then the game will be up, right? It doesn't function for them unless they make all this noise about how assertive the EPA is, right? So the problem is that for the most part, the environmental movement, but also Donald Trump, have fallen for this shadow play, right? This kabuki. And so what Donald Trump now is doing is saying, well, I'll sort it out for my friends in the chemical industry and the oil industry and so forth, right? But really, he's just somebody, a dupe who doesn't understand the game. Right, the chemical industry is probably really mad with him, because he's going to put all these people who are their own, you know, associated with them, and kind of blown the game open. But the problem is that the environmental groups, instead of understanding that, you know, there are some exceptions, but instead of understanding that actually this is an opportunity for them, have then gone and said, well, we need to support the EPA. So I have, you know, well-meaning friends who work for environmental groups who think we should be supporting the EPA, when really what they should be doing is pushing the EPA harder than ever to basically achieve the reforms that they want. Because the EPA is, like I said, is totally not protecting the public. And I can cite many, many more examples than this of collusion and between the EPA in all kinds of different ways, you know, including climate change and so on and so forth. They're still colluding with the chemical industry, fracking, you name it. So what environmental groups have done is miss their opportunity to actually challenge the EPA in a much more fundamental way. And, you know, we have to get away, as environmentalists, we have to get away from tackling chemicals on a single compound at a time process. There's totally a structural problem here with the honesty and integrity of the EPA. But it was spiked from the beginning by Richard Nixon. And we probably don't have time to go into all this, but this is really important because Richard Nixon, for example, allowed the EPA to write the rules that it then enforced, right? So EPA, basically, when Congress writes a new piece of legislation, they just give a very broad remit to EPA and say, just sort this Superfund business, right? Sort the chemical testing business, whatever. So EPA gets to write the rules, and what they end up doing is writing loopholes into their own rules so that they never have to be troubled with prosecuting the chemical industry, because all they do is need to have a quick look around the table and go, well, we're never going to win this case, therefore we're not going to fight it, and therefore we don't have to prosecute. So you've got this game that's gone on since the inception of the EPA, in which the whole agency is a facade and is not intended to do its job and never was intended to do its job, but is now being protected primarily by environmental organizations who are the chief victims of this thing. The environmental movement has largely collapsed in many ways because we have an agency that pretends to be doing their job. If people understood there was no agency, it's not doing anything, then actually there would be a chance of reform. But you have to pinpoint the problem. And this is why we got the poison, interested in the poison papers in the first place, right? It's because what I do most of the time is investigate GMOs. And I saw this collusion with the industry totally, you know, it's so obvious. When you understand the science well enough, it's so obvious. But there's no, you know, I don't have any proof that I can show to a journalist and say, look what they did, because I have access to their internal decisions and so forth. So that's why we were interested in these documents, because they provide that fundamental proof that it's really hard to get from other industries like GMOs and other ways.
Jonathan Latham, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've been speaking with the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project, which has co-published the Poison Papers. And you can find a link to the Poison Papers on our website, againstthegrain.org. Hundreds of thousands of documents about the collusion between state regulators, including the Environmental Protection Agency, and the chemical industry. You've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.